What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, and thank you so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. Please rate and review us on iTunes. So excited that I was able to chat with Samuel Moyne. Samuel Moyne is the Henry R. Luce Professor of Jurisprudence and Professor of History at, no big deal, Yale. You can make sure to follow him on Twitter at Samuel Moyne. His last name is spelled M-O-Y-N. Make sure also you check out his books on Amazon. He's working on a new book, and he's already written some really great books, including The Last Utopia, Human Rights in History. He's also a fellow of the New Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. They're a great think tank. We've had on a bunch of people affiliated with them, including Trita Parsi and Daniel Bessner, a non-resident fellow. Not sure. Got to ask Samuel if he's a resident fellow or non. Not that that matters, obviously. Samuel's also written for places like The Atlantic, Boston Review, The Chronicle of Higher Education, Commonweal, Dissent, The Guardian, The London Review of Books, The Nation, The New Republic, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. Make sure you become Patreon supporters if you're not already. If you become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. You'll be able to hear a discussion that I had with Sam, which is really interesting, on something he calls Trump washing and why he thinks that Trump is not a fascist and why he thinks it's a dangerous discussion and dangerous discourse to suggest that he is a fascist. Also on this Patreon-only episode, we talk about other issues and you get to hear me talk about Stephanie Ruhle's comments about Park Avenue, as well as Trump's statements on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it's definitely a great Patreon-only episode. Really important discussion with Sam. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Katie Halper Show. We are doing a special, unplanned, but very important, I would say, live stream. As people probably know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died, and I know a lot of people have a lot of thoughts and questions about that. So we are so lucky because we're being joined by Samuel Moyne, who is the Henry R. Luce Professor of Jurisprudence and Professor of History at Yale. Real excited. Thank you so much for joining.
Oh, thanks for having me, Katie.
Yeah, just wanted to ask you, I guess, to just kind of jump in. First of all, are you a jurist? Can I call you a jurist?
You know, that's a pretty highfalutin word. I went to law school.
But I always try to use it. Is it only
all right,
for judges?
Well, Phil, this is your chance.
All right, it's my chance. I think I've called you that and Ro Khanna that.
All right.
With varying levels of success. But yeah, can you tell us what this means? Where were you when you discovered this? Were you surprised? What your kind of immediate response was to this news about RBG, as she's called?
Well, you know, I just watched Donald Trump on Twitter say that she lived an extraordinary life, and that's true. And she was on the right side of many things. And, you know, for any feminist, she lived a dream, which was to, you know, engage in a cause and see it come to fruition and even, you know, move from advocacy to kind of some really important judicial decisions that she authored. On the other hand, her legacy is colored now. She made a bet on her longevity, and we all pay the price that she lost it. It's obviously a tragedy for her and her family, but it was an avoidable tragedy for the nation that yet another presidential election becomes about the fate of this all-powerful council of elders that we should, you know, think hard about whether we want to keep
as a council or.
Yeah, I mean, where I'd take this discussion is, you know, we have to think about her and her legacy, but we also now have, you know, yet another referendum that's supposed to be about our political leaders, but is in fact about who gets to appoint the judges on this particular court. And maybe at some point we should think about why we're doing that.
Right.
Why are we empowering an institution so much that almost we've converted democracy into who gets to be on it?
So I want to ask you about those two kind of two levels that you brought up. One is her life, right? And the significance of her as an individual, what this means, the way she kind of bet on her own longevity. And then want to get into the larger question of how we should be talking about this. But just for the kind of immediate discussion, what were her options? I mean, I think that most people thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win, right? I think because that the logic was that she was going to wait it out.
Absolutely.
She was going to wait it out and then be replaced by President Hillary Clinton.
Correct.
What would have happened had she retired under President Obama, and what could he have been able to achieve had it happened under his presidency? Because of course we saw a lot of gridlock with his attempts.
No, that's true. You know, and you're absolutely right that, you know, to second guess her, especially now that she's gone, you know, the night she died is pretty unseemly. On the other hand, she was a public figure and made choices that have affected us all now.
I think she'd want us to.
Yeah. Okay, good. Right? Well, with that assurance, let's plow ahead. You know, it would have been an incredible thing to see Hillary Clinton replace Ruth Ginsburg. And of course, most of us thought that's what would happen. On the other hand, she was, you know, grievously ill at several points. And and she was also elderly. So she could have retired in 2013. You know, that was the moment where she really missed a chance. At that point, it really wasn't predictable that, you know, Hillary would, you know, necessarily succeed Barack Obama, and she was 80 years old. Yeah. So I regard that as a pretty, pretty, you know, disastrous mistake in retrospect. The thing is, though, anyone in power, you know, wants to preserve it. And, you know, we all think we're going to live forever, you and me too. So I don't blame her so much as the fact that we've created this situation for ourselves and don't seem to want to do anything to fix it. You know, the dominant, you know, Twitter discourse right now is that we have to depoliticize the Supreme Court, put it back the way it was in some yesteryear when it was neutral. But the fact is, it's always been political. It's always been a policymaking body. And, you know, we fought over who's on it for generations now. So until we realize that we need to fix it, you know, you can't really blame those who want to be on it, who get on it, for wielding the power that we give them.
Right. And what kind of, can you just as a jurist, can you talk about her legacy, her intellectual or what's the word? Jurisprudential.
Yeah.
Jurisprudential. Is that it?
Legacy? Yeah, that's a word. You know, look, I'm not a huge expert, but I'll say a few things. You know, she emerged as, first of all, she went to law school at a time almost no women did. And she was tenacious and in getting through it. We've seen the movies now. There are multiple, you know, documentaries and movies about it. And, you know, she's an icon, not least to my own daughters. And, you know, it's incredible that she, you know, opened these possibilities and really became a model for so many people. She, as an advocate, she really devised the strategy as that led the Supreme Court before she was on it, decades before she was on it, to say that gender discrimination should be treated seriously under the Constitution, in particular under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Before then, racial discrimination had been given what's called heightened scrutiny, and she helped convince them that gender discrimination also was serious enough that the Constitution, you know, cares. And that was a major achievement. And it was really a kind of strategic, you know, on her part to figure out how to convince all male justices at that time to make the Constitution into something that could protect women. As a justice, she got this incredible opportunity to even give more teeth to, you know, protections against gender discrimination under the Constitution, most famously in a case that shut down or seriously altered the Virginia Military Institute, which had been an all-male school. And she wrote a decision. It's a classic decision that said that it's unconstitutional for there to be a state-run all-male school. You know, in later life, she became a dissenter. Some of her liberal colleagues, like Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan, began exploring a strategy of compromising with the right to kind of like make the outcomes less bad. And Ruth Ginsburg, you know, in a case like that involves voting rights, wrote a pretty impressive dissent in another case in which the Obamacare was nearly struck down and part of it was struck down. She wrote an incredibly impassioned dissent. So at the end of her life, she became much more, let's say, aggressively liberal in her rhetoric. She had been a centrist liberal and really, you know, a radical for women, but not, you know, with respect to, you know, kind of larger social issues for most of her life. Towards the end, she never became a radical, you know, in the way you and I might think of it, but she definitely would get rowdy as the court moved right from time to time.
And in terms of what could have happened, I honestly, like, did Obama have options? Could he have played harder? Were his hands really tied when he was trying to get Merrick Garland through?
You know, people have wondered if he could have done anything. You know, in the end, it's down to Mitch McConnell, who at that point controlled the Senate and seems impervious to, you know, anything other than, you know, pursuing his own power, maybe the power of his party. I'm doubtful, but, you know, as we know from the beginning, from 2009, Obama always feared himself getting rowdy, going to the people.
Right.
He was not confrontational, and he paid a huge price at several turns. Maybe it could have made a difference had he, you know, been in a way as nasty a politician as Mitch McConnell has repeatedly shown himself to be.
Right. And of course, you know, according to someone like Thomas Frank, he didn't pay the price and Obama wanted that, right? Which is not like some sinister conspiracy theory, just that often
right.
Of the Dems as being bad at playing hardball, but actually they don't want to be playing it.
I think that's right. And, you know, you go back to his selection of Garland, who's actually pretty far right. I mean, right. You know, which is, it makes it kind of, you know, an amazing choice. You know, if he thought it was going to be symbolic, he could have chosen someone further left, unless he thought choosing someone who's really quite moderate could get through. But then it turned out even that kind of compromise, you know, didn't spare him a fight. And that's like the story of Obama's life. You know, he compromises and still gets, you know, intransigence from the Republicans, right. And never learned. But it may just mean that he was pretty much a centrist all along himself and didn't want to go left or challenge the Republicans.
Right. Like, what was there to learn?
Right. That yeah. sounds like a pretty plausible
yeah.
way of interpreting it to me.
And so what's going to happen next? What are your predictions? And then we can get into kind of the larger question of what is to be done, both in terms
right.
of this particular nomination, but also, okay, so there's a problem with the way this country is run and with the Supreme Court. So now what?
Well, so in the short term,
a lot on your, you know, not to,
no, no,
you know,
yeah, well, I really do want to get to those yes. larger issues because that's what I'm actually, you know, thinking about. I mean, yeah. you know, in the short term, there are two separate questions. What does Donald Trump do and what does Mitch McConnell do? And the second question also depends on, you know, really, I suppose, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Mitt Romney. So to start with Donald Trump, you know, I think that this is in a way salvation for him. You know, anyone who's still paying attention to the pandemic is in a new space. You know, those who are politically active certainly will be on the edge of their seats for this one, on left and right. And, you know, Donald Trump will probably nominate someone, but may, you know, profit from not seeing that person, you know, confirmed immediately and making it, you know, an issue on which he can say the election should turn. And that will have, you know, incalculable impact on, you know, people on the right. Now, you know, Biden is so far to the right himself that it's not, you know, clear that it will really motivate that many people, but there may be some who really care so much about having this sixth reactionary vote on the court now that they're mobilized. You know, it's possible that Trump will, you know, I think stupidly try to collude with McConnell to get the vote to happen before the election. And that will be very difficult to achieve. It depends on whether McConnell wants to do that. And I've been having disputes with friends online about this in the last couple of hours. If McConnell cares principally about his own power, then he cares less about the Supreme Court than losing the Senate. You know, he doesn't care as much about losing the presidency, but losing the Senate means the loss of his own power, could mean the loss of his own seat, although that's unlikely. But if he cares, you know, about long-term power, he's going to wait. If, on the other hand, he cares about the Supreme Court, which it seems like he does, and he recognizes that the Republicans are about to start losing a lot of elections, and this is a golden moment to lock in generational control over the Supreme Court in a way that will be very hard for the Democrats to erode, then this is an extraordinary stroke of luck for McConnell. And more than that, he's talked about it in those terms, that if there's a vacancy, even in October, he would act. Now, we've seen statements. I mean, strangely, there was a statement from Trump before Trump actually knew that she had died, to the effect that he will nominate someone. And McConnell also put out a public statement that he will see that nominee through to a vote. Not exactly clearly by November 3rd, but certainly by January 20th. So it's a fascinating, you know, moment to see what those two will do. And I suppose McConnell's calculus, as I said, will depend, you know, on these three, you know, senators who he can't perfectly control. You know, Susan Collins has been pretty compliant. She voted for Brett Kavanaugh. She didn't vote for impeachment.
Right.
On the other hand, she was burned badly. She's got a fight in Maine, et cetera. The other two, Murkowski and Romney, have both said that they don't think that a justice should be replaced either in general in the last term, last year of a presidential term, or in this case. So, you know, did they stick to their principles, or did they, you know, take a deal? Did they decide that actually this is an extraordinary opportunity for the right? I guess time will tell.
Yeah, there are probably some resistance types, right, who think that they're gonna, who are hoping that they'll take this as an opportunity, not for the right, but for kind of the, like, I don't know, the sake of the republic or something.
Sure. No, it'll be represented that way. If, yeah, you know, Romney has become, you know, obviously a hero, even amongst liberals.
Yeah.
For, staring reality in the face.
Yeah.
Not hard. And, you know, Murkowski is, you know, an interesting figure because she doesn't seem as compliant as Collins. On the other hand, all of these people have, you know, voted for, you know, economic neoliberalism and endless war for decades. So, you know, we're talking about people who, it's like, you know, shades of black. But that matters. That could matter in this situation.
Yeah.
You know, there's some speculation that the smartest thing to do would be to use this as an election, you know, theme. And then especially if Trump loses, to push through a nomination in between the election and January 20th. And, you know, especially if the Senate's going to change hands, it's hard to, you know, not to see that happening. Those three as senators might keep McConnell from fulfilling his agenda of pushing whoever Trump nominates through. Trump has announced, you know, I think about 40 people on a list. And in fact, he added 20 a few days ago. It could be someone. I mean, Senator Ted Cruz is on that list. The folks on that list are mostly your standard, Federalist Society right wingers, some more dodgy than that.
And who do you think the scariest potential picks by Trump are?
You know, the truth is that at least when, you know, he was working with, you know, Don McGahn, you know, he really just deferred to, you know, the Federalist Society. And he's generally done so on judicial appointments, which has meant that, you know, both of his picks, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, have been, you know, groomed in the typical way. They went to one of two schools. They clerked for the Supreme Court themselves, you know, well-trained and so forth. You know, I believe that it would make sense, especially if the vote is going to be close no matter what, for him to pick someone of that kind. You know, for some of the picks in the lower judiciary, he's nominated people almost, you know, without qualification to be a judge. He won't do that for sure. He wants, you know, this pick to be respected. So I don't think we're talking about crazies, but I do think we're talking about a sixth vote for a lot of nefarious outcomes, no matter what.
Can you see the questions, by the way? Did any questions strike your fancy?
You know, they're mostly comments and pretty good ones.
Like one. Let's see. One question was, there were some interesting, let's see, Brian Fredericks.
Amy Coney Barrett, yes, will be Trump's choice. That's not implausible. I mean, I think she came very close in the prior round. And that often happens, you know. When Ginsburg was nominated everyone thought it would go to Stephen Breyer, who then got it the next time.
Right.
You know, he had a bad interview with Clinton, and he's on the court now. He's himself up there in years.
And then let's see, Sparky says, Ginsburg and Alito showed that people can be close friends, even with significant political differences. It used to be pretty common. Since Ted Cruz's fellow senators dislike him, if he's nominated for SCOTUS, he may be confirmed just so they can get rid of him. Ooh, we got to make sure, we got to somehow make Ted Cruz beloved so we can prevent that from happening.
You know, it's true that Ginsburg and Scalia were really close, and they went to the opera together and so
right
forth.
Now.
You know, my take is that's all part of this, like, almost like criminological attitude where we're curious about those who wield power over us. And, you know, it's nice that they got along, but is that what we want our political discussion to be about?
Right.
You know, especially we didn't vote for these people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember when Scalia died, I wrote something for Salon and they gave it like a really annoying title, but it was basically about how I wasn't sad that he was dead. I wasn't sad he was off the court. And I think he was an odious human being who I believe he actually ruled that or said or wrote that the Constitution doesn't bar or doesn't prevent or prohibit someone from being executed if they were legally represented, even if they're innocent.
It's very possible, you know, he was a, you know, an originalist, which means that, you know, the Eighth Amendment, you know, barring cruel and unusual punishment, he thought that couldn't include things, you know, that changed morally since the 18th century.
Right.
And maybe that was one of them.
Yeah. Funny guy, though. Seemed very funny.
Oh, brilliant and funny. And, you know, I teach the court's opinions to law students, and he's, you know, easily the most readable and enjoyable writer the court has seen in generations.
Who's the dumbest?
Right now?
Right now in history, whichever.
You know, I find that a hard one, because it was often thought that Clarence Thomas was an idiot. He never spoke at oral argument. And it was said that his clerks wrote his opinions. I actually think he's brilliant. I mean, I think he has a nefarious political project, but he's, envision some outcomes that the court as a whole has later reached. And a lot of the dismissal of him was a kind of liberal racism.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I mean, these are all smart people.
Yeah, that's a scary thing, right?
They are, you know, we watch the court and we watch people doing politics in the name of law, and they're very good at what they do. They've sustained this illusion that when they make policy choices, it's the law making them for 200 years now. And, you know, I just think we should emphasize that that's a lie. And, you know, we should make our own political decisions, not shunt it off and pretend that they've already been made in some, you know, dusty old piece of parchment.
Right. Alito and Kavanaugh, are they really as smart as the other ones?
They're smart guys. You know, I mean, I have trouble ranking them because they are good at what they do.
Yeah.
Well-trained and well-groomed. And, I don't think Alito did, but Kavanaugh certainly prepared to do this from a young age. And, if you put your mind to it, you can get good at some things.
Right.
Apparently being a Supreme Court justice is one of them.
Right. Okay. And so let's talk a little bit about, well, first of all, who do you think Biden would nominate?
I think Biden would nominate a you know, liberal of some kind. You know, we know that his priors, his proclivities are, you know, centrist. And it's really hard to say. I mean, I would hope he would, as someone who didn't go to Harvard or Yale, kind of revive this old tradition that you may need to be a lawyer, but you don't need to be a judge, and you don't need to be, you know, minted by one of these elite schools to play this role. You know, even in recent days, he's emphasized that it's still, in a sense, an outsider. And some of the recent profiles for, you know, all that you and I might, you know, dunk on him, you know, he does still have a sense that, you know, he's never been respected by Washington elites, you know, because of his background and his education. And, you know, I think the Supreme Court was a better thing, always bad, but a better thing when, you know, there was a range of Americans on it and not just those who have gone to my school.
Your school as in someone at Yale?
Actually Ginsburg's death means that there's no one on the court that didn't go to Harvard or didn't graduate from Harvard or Yale. She started at Harvard and graduated from Columbia. All the rest, I think it's now 4-4 Harvard, Yale. Let's see.
She started at Harvard undergrad and did Columbia
no,
Law?
She started at Harvard Law, but because she was married with children and her husband graduated before her and moved to New York, she transferred to Columbia and graduated from there.
She stepped down. She took it a notch
down. She took a huge step down.
Yeah, but a much better city, let's be honest.
I think that's right.
Cambridge versus New York.
Yeah.
Can't really blame her.
It's no contest.
Yeah. So let's see. Biden, as someone who, what did he help do? He was pro-bus, anti-busing, because he thought busing was, as he said, this is one of my favorite Biden arguments, that it was a rejection of Black is beautiful. He tried to pretend that the reason he opposed busing was because it was assimilationist.
Right. He said that not at the time, but more recently.
No, he said it at the time.
At the time. Okay. Yeah.
He said Black is beautiful. Like he said, yeah. It's a rejection of, yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't use probably the word assimilationist then, but he definitely used that, the Black pride, Black is beautiful thing, which is a.
You know, the best amazing. You can say about Biden is that he seems to conform to what everyone else is saying,
right.
Like the center of the party. And, you know, the center of the party for all of its, you know, defects has moved a fair bit. And so he's moving too, you know. The million-dollar question, if he wins, no matter what happens with the Supreme Court, is how is Biden going to govern? And above all, who is he going to appoint himself to various positions? You know, Stephen Breyer is not going to be on the court that much longer, and the next president presumably will get to replace him. And, you know, that's going to be on Biden. But we've got a big, you know, bump in the road now before any of that can happen.
And then what about expanding the court and packing the court? And before then, I just want to share some trivia. Do you know why Rehnquist added golden stripes to his robe?
It had to do with the musical.
Florida. Yeah. Ayalon.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, sure. And I think he was very proud of sporting those gold bars during Bill Clinton's impeachment.
Right. Yeah. Interesting guy.
Yes.
Big fan of Hush Puppies.
Ah, okay. Well,
yeah,
that's one thing I share
puppies,
with.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought we were talking about the food.
Oh, no. He wore the Hush Puppy shoes. Yeah.
All right. Very good.
And so let's talk about expanding the court, packing the court. That's very controversial. People on both sides of the political spectrum have, you know, there's overlap, there's disagreement. It's not quite, doesn't fall neatly.
Right.
Along the the political spectrum. So what's your hot take?
So, you know, basically, you know, court packing was tried by Franklin Roosevelt in 1937. It failed, but most people think it shifted the court kind of indirectly. And it's even though a lot of other, you know, reforms to the Supreme Court have been proposed in U.S. history, court packing is like on people's minds anytime the topic comes up. So when, you know, when McConnell acted to deprive the Democrats of their seat, people began to talk about court packing again after 60 years, 70 years. The idea was that the court had to be unstolen, and that would be done by appointing extra justices once the Democrats were in power. Today, there's a huge spike in court packing talk because if McConnell gets, you know, a second, illicit justice appointed, the Democrats, it's thought, have to strike back and, you know, add two of their own or more. Now, it's very divisive for a few reasons. One is that the number of justices, 9, has been stable since the 19th century. And, you know, some people even think it would be unconstitutional to add justices. There's also a risk, if you think power will change hands, that it will start this escalatory cycle and, you know, soon we'll have hundreds of justices. That's actually happened in Poland. And so some people think it's, you know, sort of, you know, would lead to Armageddon. Now, we're already in Armageddon in a sense, so it's not clear that that matters that much. You know, my take is that, you know, court packing, it changes who's on the court, but not the power of the court. And so I think we should consider other approaches to the court that aren't just about getting our friends on it and letting them rule us instead of the right. Because I think we should rule ourselves in a democracy. So, you know, some proposals that work that way would include what's called jurisdiction stripping. So the idea of jurisdiction stripping is that when you pass H.R. 1 or the Green New Deal, you say this is not reviewable in the Supreme Court or the federal judiciary. You disallow the courts from the ability to hear cases on certain topics. There's also a proposal to make the justices work by a supermajority rule rather than a majority rule, like 6-3 or 7-2. And the idea there is that when something's flagrantly unconstitutional and 8 or 9 justices can agree that it is, Democrats and Republicans, they can overturn the law. But when not that many agree, then the law stands. And so it's a way, an effect of transferring power back to the political branches and especially the Congress. There are other such fixes, but you know, those are the ones I favor. That they're about kind of shifting power away from the court rather than changing who the personnel are on the court.
And so how would that be achieved? How quickly could that happen? What are all the
well, all of these would require statutes. So to court pack, you'd have to pass a law that expanded the Supreme Court. And then you'd have to nominate and confirm each new justice.
Can you say that again? Sorry, you cut out for a second. For court packing,
you'd have to first pass a law, both houses of Congress, presidential signature, saying that the Supreme Court is now X justices, 11, 13, 100. And then for each vacancy, you'd have to have the president nominate a new judge and confirm that person in the Senate. Very laborious. The other, remedies I discussed also require statutes, laws passed. In the case of jurisdiction stripping, you don't need to pass a new law. You just, whenever you pass a law about something you want, like H.R. 1 for democracy or the Green New Deal or whatever, you just add to that law provisions that, you know, forbid the Supreme Court or the federal judiciary from hearing constitutional challenges. Now, you know, the court can always say, you can't take our power away. you know, but they can also say you can't add justices to the Supreme Court. So all of these proposals to challenge the court can face the obstruction of the court itself. And so like we'd have to get into a lot of detail, like which of these might work better, which would be less easy for the court itself to disallow, which might be less risky if the Republicans get back into power. You know, I mentioned that court packing, the risk is that they'll just pack again when they're in power and put their people on. And suddenly we're in like a situation where every election, the Supreme Court expands. Some of those other reforms I mentioned seem not to have that same risk, because if the court is less powerful, then we fight less about it. And we don't have national soul searching and debate about every justice, which is my dream. Like, what if we actually talked about policy rather than which lawyers are going to serve on this council of elders to take the place of democracy?
Right. Yeah. And you say that as a lawyer, right?
I went to law school.
Yeah. As a jurist.
As a jurist, I say that juristocracy is bad. Right. Democracy is good.
Yeah. It's interesting. Did you, that so many people who are actually, who study the law are so, you guys seem to have a kind of tortured relationship with it.
Well, no, I mean, most lawyers love the Supreme Court and they love, you know, rule of the country via the legal profession. But right. No wonder. I mean, it's a, you know, that's saying they love ruling them, you know, exercising the power to rule themselves.
Yeah, I guess leftists, I should say.
Oh, leftists. Yeah. No, I think leftists have always had a serious quandary about the legal profession, which has generally been, you know, pretty conservative unless you piss it off.
Right. And I want to know your thoughts on Julian Assange.
I think that these cases of Assange and Snowden are, you know, testaments to an overweening, you know, surveillance and security state, and that. One of the amazing things that happened lately, of course, was that Donald Trump didn't reject pardoning Snowden outright, but said he would think about it. I think that if we're interested in the continuities we're talking about before, I think we have to look deeper at the way in which the uses of state power have been pretty bad long before Donald Trump, the fascist, ever arose. And someone like Assange, is testament to that. You may not agree with everything he's done, but, you know, the question, you know, that we should care about is, should he be tried under, you know, under these statutes. And I think the answer is pretty clear. You know, I think that, you know, WikiLeaks revealed true facts about, you know, electoral hijinks, you know, not that the Russians were committing, though they've committed their fair share, but that the Democratic, national Democratic Party was engaged in. And that wasn't post-truth. It was part of the truth that it was useful for us to know. Now, there's room for, you know, laws that protect privacy and protect property. And he may have broken some, but, you know, there's also room for, transparency and, you know, the public right to know. But above all, I think, you know, the question is, should we get punitive with these guys once we've seen the service they've done for the public? And I just think the answer is clearly no.
Yeah. It seems like, I mean, it's so mind-boggling, although it shouldn't be, I guess, that how little attention the media is paying to this story.
Right.
And all the people who talk about Trump being an existential threat and being a, you know, an enemy to free press, freedom of speech. It drives me crazy that these same people are okay siding with Pompeo and Trump on this issue when Obama, who these same, you know, Mick resistance people love and praise as a nuanced, rational thinker, respecter of the rule of law and the Constitution. Why aren't they siding with him? Right. Not that he was perfect on this at all, but first of all, they claim he was. And secondly, he did not pursue Assange on this issue.
Right. Well, it seems as if the red thread is that they oppose people who challenge their own power.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you can reconcile. The principles are often noble that are invoked, and that's there's something to, you know, celebrate about that. But then you demand that they're the people live by them less selectively.
Right. Yeah. Also, so many of the principles I feel like are often like the freakouts are. The freakouts are often, I think, about decorum and, you know,
yeah, I think that's fair.
We're taking off the mask. Like, hearing
I think
that
that's fair. Yeah. I think that's fair. On the other hand, I think we should welcome it, even when the invocations of principles are opportunistic, when people, it kind of dawns on people once Donald Trump has powers we gave prior presidents, that the powers themselves are bad. You see that to some degree in the war context. Where a lot of, you know, right-thinking people say we need fundamental reform to the way we allocate war powers in this country. And the fact that, you know, they supported that allocation when it was George W. Bush or Barack Obama wielding it, and then kind of the scales fall from their eyes when Trump does, you know, it's revealing, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't cultivate allies when we can agree that, you know, the power itself needs to be challenged.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. The ultimate goal is not to own the libs as having.
I mean, as satisfying as that is, the outcomes matter more.
Right. Yeah. No, I think it's true. I mean, I think we all have different roles to play, but people should be invited to apply these principles, universally or consistently. Someone actually who's watching the show texted me, a friend of mine, want to know about major upcoming decisions or issues that could be affected. And also, if you could get into Trump's general effect on the federal judiciary, which most people don't know about, probably his most significant actions.
Great. Those are both great, questions. So, to my knowledge, there are some big effects of Ruth Ginsburg's, tragic passing. One is that there are 8 justices, which means that if it's 4-4, there's no decision. And that's of particular significance in, all the cases that come up starting in October, when there will certainly be no new justice. The most obvious one is the latest challenge to the American, the Obamacare statute, which was passed so long ago and has been challenged repeatedly and is now being challenged because it said that zeroing that making the penalty or tax that Americans have to pay if they don't get Obamacare makes the whole statute unconstitutional. And that's been a closely watched case. It seems like it may come out 4-4 now. I think that means that the lower court ruling out of Texas will stand, which is a bad thing. On the second question, which is a great one, it's absolutely true that Trump, largely as a result of Don McGahn, who's broken with Trump, helped in the Mueller investigation and no longer works at the White House, really did an extraordinary job in getting conservative judges, not Supreme Court justices, through in cooperation with Mitch McConnell. And so I think, it's fair to say that Trump is the most successful president in the last few decades at stocking the bench. We have a Trumpified judiciary, no matter what happens to Ginsburg's seat on the Supreme Court. And, you know, a lot of Democrats rightly argue that since the Supreme Court hears so few cases relative to the judiciary as a whole, we really ought to prioritize reform of the whole judiciary. It could be possible, for example, to just add lots of judges below the Supreme Court. That was done last time under Jimmy Carter. And, you know, I support that. You know, it's, let's say, pretty ordinary in American history to expand the overall size of the judiciary. In this case, you know, Trump has not abused norms. He's just been very focused and very good at filling openings in the judiciary. So, you know, from my druthers, I'd rather keep our, you know, minds on the Supreme Court for two reasons. First, you know, there is a good case that the Supreme Court is so far right because of all of these hijinks and irregularities. And second, its power is just much greater than the rest of the judiciary because it's has the final word. It, you know, it has, because of this idea in American history of judicial supremacy, not just the final word relative to the other courts, but relative to the other branches of government. And, you know, that's why I've been making this case for disempowering the institution. And so, you know, the questioner is absolutely right, though, that we definitely need to care about the short term, what happens in October, and about the lower courts alongside our fears about what will happen to the highest court.
And have your politics changed over time? I'm just curious. Have your views on the law, on history, on politics, have they changed over time?
You know, not as much as my critics think. You know, I have changed my views, you know, in the area in which I used to work in international affairs. I was in the 90s when I worked in the Clinton White House as an intern on the Kosovo wars, a defender of humanitarian intervention. I believed in it, and I've since been, you know, pretty critical of it. But, you know, my basic, you know, priors have been left for a long time. You know, what's different for those of us who are older, you know, like me, is that the 90s, you know, the era of the end of history, were a hard time to be a young person, as I was then, because, you know, if you drank the Kool-Aid that we were offered by our teachers and elders, there really wasn't, you know, much prospect of a left renaissance. And that's happened in just in the past few years, which has been an extraordinary thing. So I think younger people are, in a sense, lucky. Now, they've been driven by, you know, the excesses and outrages of their lived experience after 2008, which I, you know, have, you know, had been cushioned from. But, you know, I'm really eager to see what those young people are going to make of the world. I think they're beyond many of the mythologies that I was offered as, you know, when I was their age. And, you know, they're also lucky for that reason.
And just want to say, Katie, you should have Sam on your show often. I agree. Thank you, Sparky, for that comment.
Thanks, Sparky. Anytime, obviously.
What made you change on the intervention issue? For humanitarian intervention.
Well, so, you know, I principally the Iraq war, when I saw that all the rationales that we had come up with were cynically used by, you know, neoconservatives opportunistically. But I also, you know, began to think much more critically about the extraordinary hierarchical power my country enjoys relative to all the others. And, you know, the kind of noblesse oblige attitude that young Americans were offered when, you know, I was more impressionable, you know, I came to think of as it, you know, itself intolerable. And, you know, when you see events like we saw this summer, you begin to think that if anyone needs a humanitarian intervention, it's us.
Yeah. So there are two things that I want to say. I'll say them out loud so that I, in case I forget them. But one is the issue of casualties. And then the other is the issue of meritocracy in the Supreme Court. But it seems like, it seems to me like, you know, when I remember, like, I actually saw this play Embedded that Tim Robbins wrote, that's about
I remember hearing about that. Yeah.
And then we turned it into a movie. I helped produce that.
Cool.
Yeah, in a past life. But I remember Patricia Clarkson, who was who came to the screening. We were interviewing people, and she talked about how much she realized that the word casualties, how much that downplays what happens to people. And it's true. And I didn't realize that until she said that. And she's like, you know, a casualty can be someone losing a limb, losing two limbs. And it's true. I would always be like relieved when I would hear about, you know, this number of deaths and this number of only casualties. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, obviously death is worse. Although with modern warfare and stuff, it's, you know, not even modern warfare, that song, what is it, Waltzing Matilda, that like really brutal song about coming back from Gallipoli and, you know, not being able to dance. And, but especially now because of medicine advancing so much, you have people coming back and surviving in ways they couldn't have even then. Anyway, but yes, this issue of, you know, people may not be killed, they may be maimed, they may just have PTSD. From here, and then the populations there, all those things, plus destabilization. I mean, that's the other thing. It's just the economic the devastation that happens, even when people aren't killed or maimed.
Absolutely. Yeah. No one should be, you know, celebrating, since, you know, you can't trivialize the residual violence and nonviolent consequences of wars. I mean, you can say, if we agree that death is the worst thing, that it's extraordinary how less fatal war is today. You know, in American wars, something like 4 to 6 million Vietnamese died in that, you know, war, and we're just nowhere near those totals. As you say, we should be very attentive to the way in which what's to get substituted for death is, you know, other forms of harm. You know, at the end of the story, the question is, what are the nonviolent forms of harm? So, you know, if you have drones constantly flying overhead, or, you know, they could strike and rarely do, it's a pretty chilling picture.
Right.
And, you know, it seems as if a lot of folks who care about making war more humane would like to see something like a globalized American policing. Mm. Now, we know that American policing in America is brutal and violent. But, you know, you can ask at home and abroad, what do we want, for there to be nonviolent policing or to abolish policing? Doesn't it reflect these hierarchies we sustain, that we have some people policed and others not? And, you know, to me, surveillance and policing, the kind of thing that got Edward Snowden so upset, are also chilling forms of domination. And so we can't, in our zeal to care about like the worst things on the continuum, you know, death, violent injury, PTSD, forget that like what we're substituting also has its dark side.
Right. What we're substituting. Yeah, exactly. And of course, the in purely kind of self-interested national security terms, it's just, you know, the droning does not exactly make a population more friendly.
No. So, I mean, you know, these strategies, I mean, all of the strategies on the continuum have been self-defeating and worsen the problem they set out to solve.
Right.
And that's true of the biggest wars, Iraq, down the down the continuum to, you know, drones and so forth. So like, you know, if we were in charge, we wouldn't be doing any of this because it's counterproductive.
Right.
But the point is that, you know, we have some large group of people who think, you know, terrorism's a problem. And as long as we conduct American hegemony humanely, we're good people. And that's what I'm saying is false. You know, so we can't convince enough people that like American hegemony and all of the acts that have been involved in it cause blowback, make things worse, not just for the, you know, them, but for us. And so I think, you know, I'm just trying to focus on people who then say, no, but we've made it more humane. We,
right.
we formed a cause group to lessen the civilian casualties. But let's not talk about the war itself. And, you know,
right.
That's a moral error.
Right.
And we should call them on it.
Going back to the issue of, I agree, let's call them out. Some we can call out, some we can call in, but the ones that we're not going to get, we got to call them out. That's an interesting calculation.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Right?
It goes back to our earlier discussion about owning people versus recruiting
exactly,
them.
Right. Exactly, right.
And compromising with them.
Yeah. Thank you, Robin Bennett, for this super sticker. And then it also seems that there's a, you know, the kind of belief in, I think there's a difference between admitting when people are smart, like you were doing, and then pretending that they're apolitical. So,
of course.
And not what you were not doing, but it just makes me think of how, like, there's so much faith in the system of meritocracy and technocracy, and you see it applied to the Supreme Court also, right? Like, these guys are really smart, which is true, but they're also ideologues.
Correct.
And they do, you know, there's this, it's a kind of like, and so many people believe it, even smart people with good politics, they really do believe that there's just something kind of okay and noble about that happening. And these guys really know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Which they do, but they are also using it, right?
That's right.
Achieve certain things.
I look, the dream that education would entitle people to rule without being self-serving is very old, and it's been constantly proved illusory. You know, that's why I think this election, for all of its shortcomings, it is exciting at the very least, in that we have two of the, you know, worst educated people. And, you know, they're not the brightest either, squaring off against each other. It's not like an intra-Ivy League contest like we're used to. And I think that, you know, suggests that people are seeing through more and more, you know, the failure of elite governance. And, you know, I'm on the hook because I'm, you know, I went to some of these schools and now I teach at them. And yet, you know, I think... I side with those who intuit that, you know, the emperors have no clothes, and we need, you know, forms of commentary, whether in elite spaces or popular ones, that call them out and, you know, suggest that merit as we've defined it is not a real distinction.
Merit. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's very seductive, and it's very easy for people to think that they're just being smart by letting other people be the smartest guys in the room.
Right. I mean, it would be different if, you know, they have the goods. And I just think it's very important in an age of attack on expertise in science to say, you know, it can't be a totalistic skepticism, because there are things that you really do need training to know about, you know, notably in, you know, natural science. You know, I don't want either Biden or Trump in charge of nuclear policy.
Right.
You know, they may have some input, but we need, you know, people dealing with the COVID crisis who have been trained in public health.
Right.
That said, a lot of policy making has been about advancing the interests of the few in the name of the good of all, and it's proven disastrous in so many cases. And that's what's been bankrupted in, you know, our experience. So, like, we need less expertise, but also to preserve the right expertise in the right places.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm not saying I'm not like obviously let's have a give this guy a shot.
Right.
John Doe, what do you think about COVID?
Right.
How would devise a vaccine? Obviously, there are places for expertise and training, but it's more the idea that it's an ideology free zone.
Yeah.
What happens with the
that's what, you know, that really does link to the core of our discussion, because, you know, the central illusion or myth about the Supreme Court in particular and the law in general is that it's not politics, that there are some techniques that great jurists have of floating above ideology and doing something else. And, you know, there's no amount of work that's too much to convince people that that's just, you know, not true. And, you know, I think that, you know, the Ruth Ginsburg's death gives us an opportunity either to like double down on Supreme Court worship or to erode, you know, this cult that, you know, has been so central to Americans, political beliefs for so long. That's what's at stake as I see it.
And so how would we push in one direction over the other?
Well, you know, it's going to be tough because if indeed, you know, McConnell and Trump together succeed in replacing her, I think it's almost, you know, I can't imagine that Biden wouldn't be pushed to attempt to court pack. And that will consume a lot of airtime in the next, you know, year or years. So I think it's really about like making principled arguments about strategies of getting the less power vested in this institution rather than struggling over it. You know, from my lifetime, you know, in 1986, I was a teenager when Robert Bork they kicked off the era of like intense recrimination over Supreme Court nominees. So that's, you know, 30, 40 years now, in which these psychodramas of Supreme Court appointment have like sucked up the policy space and, you know, all other debates, for at least a lot of a time, in those decades. And if instead of getting sucked into them, you know, we could take a step back and just ask to play a different game, namely a democratic game, I think it would be much better off in the long term.
Yeah. Last thing I want to ask you about was, books to plug. They're asking about your books. So talk about your books.
Well, I've written some. They're on Amazon. The one that came out most recently is called Not Enough, : Human Rights in an Unequal World. And it's about the way in which human rights haven't been kind of posed a challenge or threat to neoliberalism, but have kind of coexisted with it. And then look for in about a year for this new book, which is, I think, going to be called something like Humane or Humane War, but the publishers haven't decided yet.
Okay, great. Yeah. And definitely follow Sam on Twitter.
Absolutely. And then, I have so few followers.
Really? We're going to give you that Katie Halberstam bump.
All right, great.
We got to make it happen. Everyone follow Sam. I put
only if you're interested.
Only if you're interested, yeah. You're why? Okay, thank you so much. And I'll be making, I'll be sure to make this into a podcast too, because it's been
okay, great. Discussion. I've enjoyed it and I really appreciate the invite and see you next time, I hope.
Yeah, definitely come on again.
Okay, all right, have a good night.
Hopefully under happier circumstances.
Right. Rest in peace.
And how do you balance, I mean, do you think that Trump will be worse for the world and the country than Biden will be?
Yes. You know, I think the best outcome would be for Biden to win, in my view, and then for us to make sure to both pressure him to the left and make sure that we not Trump wash and scapegoat Trump for our sins and instead like own them and, you know, make sure that Biden is not a kind of excuse for staring in the mirror.
Right. For both like moral or preventative long-term reasons, but also just an immediate, in terms of immediate reasons, like you were saying, no one wants to be talked to like they're fascists.
Absolutely. I absolutely. Yeah. I think that's well put.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I'm going to stay on, talk to people. I'm going to play this video if Kelly tells me it's copyright safe of Trump responding to RBG's death. And also I'm going to play the Stephanie Ruhle responding to Joe Biden's, you know, war, Scranton versus Park Avenue statement. So thank you again so much, Sam.
All right. Thanks. See you next time.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, guys. I will see you guys later. This was fun. And yeah, I think we learned a lot. Right. I'll see you guys Sunday night. I'm having on Eugene Puryear, at least Eugene Puryear, to talk about the recent crackdown on Party for Socialism and Liberation, PSL. I'm also going to have so we'll be talking about that and other things like that. And then we will also be just talking about the news and stuff like that in general. So, all right. See you again that Sunday at 7 p.m. Bye, everyone. And thanks again so much to Sam. Bye. Thanks so much for listening to the Katie Halper Show. And I, as promised at the end of the interview, I do indeed find Waltzing Matilda for you guys. And I also find the Stephanie Ruhle clip. And I also find Trump on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And so to have access to that, as well as a really important discussion with Sam about various things, including why Trump is not a fascist and why it's actually dangerous to call him a fascist, go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. If you can't afford the $5 a month, you can just support the show, help make it happen for $1 a month. That's $12 a year. Okay, thank you guys so much. Have a blessed week. I can say that as an atheist, right? Agnostic, really.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Cachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to cachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.